And it's now my pleasure to introduce our speakers. So let me grab that. So first of all, I'm Paul Schwartz. I'm the Jefferson E. Pizer Professor of Law at UC Berkeley School of Law. Next to me is our main speaker, Ross Anderson, Professor of Security Engineering at Cambridge University, where his research ranges from cryptography through hardware tamper resistance and peer-to-peer systems. He initiated the study of security while on visits to Berkeley in 2001 to 2002, working with Hal Varian, and organized the first workshop on the subject here in 2001. He's a fellow of the Royal Society and of the Royal Academy of Engineering. Next to him is James Aquilina, Executive Managing Director of Stroh Friedberg, a global leader in investigations, intelligence, and risk management. He supervises numerous digital forensic, internet investigative, and electronic discovery assignments for government agencies, major law firms, and corporate management departments. We'll then be having two speakers from the world of academia. Next to James is Carl Shapiro, the Transamerica Professor of Business Strategy in the Haas School of Business of the University of California at Berkeley. Mr. Shapiro had the honor of serving as a member of the President's Council on Economic Advisers during 2011 to 2012. For the 2 years immediately prior to that, he was Deputy Assistant Attorney General for Economics at the Antitrust Division of the U.S. Department of Justice. Next to him is Anupam Chander, the Director of the California International Law Center and Martin Luther King Jr. Hall Research Scholar. His research focuses on the regulation of globalization and digitalization. Finally, I would like to thank the wonderful staff of the Berkeley Center for Law and Technology that made this event today possible. So thank you to Aaron Proudfoot, Claire Trias, Louise Lee, and our director, Robert Barr. So we will now hear from Ross.
Thanks, Paul. So the title of my talk is Privacy versus Government Surveillance, Where Network Effects Meet Public Choice. And there's a paper of that name at the top of my website, which you can download. This is the first time I've given a full presentation of the paper. I gave a shorter talk at WISE in June. And one of the things that I started thinking about when I was asked to give this talk is that Paul asked me to say what, you know, would be the view of a non-US person on Snowden. And so I dug in and started looking at the Snowden papers in detail, and I started thinking, well, what's the relevance of this to the kind of things that we've been doing between Cambridge and Berkeley about network economics and how this plays out in the information security world? And one of the things that I began to realize is that there are two quite different views of money and power, which are highlighted through the Snowden papers. Here in the Bay Area, money and power are all about network effects, because these help you create a platform to which everybody else then adds value. And we've seen this again and again with Microsoft versus Apple, with Google, with Facebook. We see that those who get the network effects going first can build platforms and can create enormous value. But in Washington, D.C., there's a very different view, an almost mercantilist view, that power is about having more tanks and aircraft carriers, and if you've got greater taxation capacity, then you can have more of those than anybody else. And as I've dug into this, I've realized, to my surprise, that almost no one talks of network effects there or among scholars of government, among the international relations community. Now, this, I think, is going to have to change, because the thing that started me off on this trail was observing in the Snowden papers the way India has changed its behavior over the past 30 years. If you go back to the 1980s, India would buy its jet fighters from Russia, despite the fact that it was a parliamentary democracy. Why? Because Sukhois were cheaper. But now we learn that India, like many other countries, is sharing intelligence with the NSA rather than the FSB because the NSA's network is bigger. And although previously we had known about the Five Eyes who make up the NSA's network, America, Canada, Britain, Australia, and New Zealand, Snowden tells us that it's bigger. There's a sort of inner circle of 15 and an outer circle of 35, And if you include secondary networks, such as those countries which are in Britain's network and which feed into the Five Eyes, it's something like 65. So you've got a growing network of countries who are involved in sharing the kind of online intelligence that the NSA does its business in. Now, back in the late 1990s, Carl over there and Hal Varian wrote an extraordinarily influential book, Information Rules, where they explained how network effects work. And as the takeaway summary that I got from that book, there are three things that make markets for information, for software and services different. The first is that many IT products and service markets have network effects. We've all heard of Metcalfe's law that the value of a network is the square of the number of users. And although you can argue about the numbers, there's no doubt that networks have got positive returns to scale. And these apply whether you're talking about real networks like phones, fax, and email, or Facebook, where you use that medium directly to communicate, or virtual networks such as PC versus Mac, where you've got a two-sided market of suppliers of software on the one hand and users on the other hand. And there are even markets that are a bit of both. Visa and MasterCard are payment networks in the sense that they have infrastructure that ships transactions around, and they're also two-sided markets because you need to get merchants before you can get cardholders and vice versa. And where you get network effects, these tend to lead to dominant firm markets where the winner takes all. The second thing that you find in IT products and service markets is that you get high fixed costs and low marginal costs. I mean, we've seen this before, for example, in airlines and hotels, but with information systems, you see it in spades. Because economics 101 tells you that if you've got price competition, this drives down prices to the marginal cost of production. Marginal cost of production of information is zero. So how on earth can you get your investment back? Well, maybe patents, brands, network effects. The third thing that makes IT markets different is that switching is expensive. If you switch from Windows to Linux, it means you've got to retrain staff and rewrite apps. And if you had a law firm where you've got 100 fee earners, where everybody has had $200 worth of Microsoft software bought for them in the form of Office and Windows, so they can do writs and conveyances and stuff, then how much would it take a typical firm to change? Well, it's obviously about that amount of money, because if it would be easier to switch to Linux or to Google Docs or whatever, then firms would switch. And if it was more expensive, Microsoft would put its prices up. So Shapiro and Varian's observation is that the net present value of a software company is the total switching costs, which is neat. It lets us get a quantitative handle on these things. Now, starting in 2001, 2002, we started applying these ideas to information security. Up until then, we saw information security as, you know, stuff going wrong, as needing more firewalls, needing more encryption, and so on. But that didn't fix stuff, and we began to realize that the incentives were at the core of the problem. Now, when you look at information goods and services markets, the combination of network effects, low marginal costs, and technical lock-in means that you tend to get monopolies, all the monopolies that we know and love and that provide so much employment hereabouts. And they also explain security and privacy failures, because if you're in a market race, the natural way to behave is ship it Tuesday and get it right by version 3. That was actually the slogan on Microsoft's campus 20-odd years ago when they were a small firm, because they were engaged in this race with Apple and then IBM, and everybody knew that you just had to beat people to markets so that you got the dominant position. But it's not just that their incentives work against quality. It's that if you're in a market race, you open up your system to appeal to complementers such as app writers. So early versions of Windows had no access control, making it easier to write software than would have been the case with, say, Unix. And exactly the same thing we've seen again and again with other platforms since, mobile phone platforms, social media platforms, and all the rest of them. But once you have won a market race, you lock it down to extract rents. And so we see a pattern in one market after another that you start off with an insecure platform, because winning the race is all that matters, and then you lock it down, but in ways that are designed to lock your customers in rather than particularly to protect them. And this has all been very, very well documented since then. Now, this is about privacy, and so there's a separate thread of research on the economics of privacy, which is also associated with Berkeley. the security economics we got going while I was here in sabbatical in 2001 too. And at that time, one of the research students was Alessandro Acisti, who started thinking about privacy. Why is it that privacy is so paradoxical? Why is it that people say that they want privacy but then behave otherwise? Well, again, Alessandro and others have found that there are always network effects and other complicating factors, and still more, there's asymmetric information, users don't know what gets done with the data, there's hyperbolic discounting, many people don't care much about what happens next year or the year after. And the net effect of all this is that people who do privacy startups tend to go bust. So this is real interesting stuff, and it's something that has been explored now by researchers for a number of years. And by now, there's over 100 active researchers working on the economics of security and privacy. So in addition to the models of what would go wrong in theory, there's measurements of what goes wrong in practice, which is something my team does a fair bit of nowadays. We collect spam and phish and stuff like that, and we test whether the models are reflecting reality. We can then come up for policy recommendations of who might be able to do what. And of course, the lobbyists usually manage to twist these around so they don't have exactly the effect that you might want it. So far, so good. So the point of my talk is that the next research frontier for those who are interested in privacy is the economics of surveillance. Why are we in the bind we're in? Well, my point is that the things already discussed, the network effects, the technical lock-in and so on, and the industry structures that they induce, are a large part of the problem. Because first, we've concentrated much of the tech industry into and around a few large service firms, Microsoft, Google, Yahoo, Facebook, and that made the PRISM program entirely foreseeable, except in its engineering details. Because once you've got the biggest, fattest target on the planet, if it's in your jurisdiction, if you can serve a warrant on it, you're going to tap the guys on the shoulder. How would you expect that law enforcement and intelligence would ever act otherwise? And the same thing happened in telecoms. The internet backbone has been hugely consolidated in the last half dozen years. Instead of having 20-odd tier one providers, there's level three. Hey, same thing applies. But that's not all. Let's go through the three things that we discussed earlier. Firstly, network effects. We already noted that network effects are perhaps the main reason, certainly a substantial reason, why many countries partner with the NSA rather than partnering with other networks. Subnetworks feed in stuff too. But here there are complications, because we end up finding, for example, that the same surveillance mechanisms that we use and that are produced by Western companies are also used by the bad guys. So the government of Syria, for example, uses mass surveillance kit made in Germany by a British company to watch what everybody's doing and decide who they're going to murder tomorrow. And this has led to terrible problems about export control, because on the one hand, NGOs say we shouldn't export this stuff to these bad guys. And on the other hand, GCHQ says, well, look, we might end up in a war with these guys, so if there's going to be black boxes in Assad's network, they'd better be our black boxes rather than the Ukrainians' black boxes. So network effects immediately precipitate us into political and civil rights problems, because networks pool people and stuff together, good people and bad people. Second, low marginal costs. Well, look at warfare. In medieval times, warfare was all about marginal expenditures. Your peasants owed you 40 days service a year in peacetime and 60 days in wartime. So it was all labor and no capital. Almost the same in World War I. By World War II, we were sending many fewer people to Germany, but an awful lot more capital in the form of tanks and planes and field guns and so on and so forth. And nowadays, we've gone to almost the other extreme. If we want to kill a foreign dictator nowadays, we don't have to land 300,000 men on his shores and, you know, have the bombers droning overhead. You can send a single drone, fire a single round of hellfire, which costs a mere $30,000 to the taxpayer. But this works only because it's backed by trillions of dollars of capital investment. The companies that make up the feed to the PRISM intelligence service alone have got a market cap of over $1 trillion. So warfare has gone from labor to capital. And then, of course, there's very complex technical lock-in games. And in this kind of environment, these are even more complex than you find in Silicon Valley business strategies. Again, 30 years ago, lock-in was basically about ammunition and spares, and it wasn't very tight. Now it's all about whether people are using Cisco routers or Huawei routers, and it turns out to be very, very expensive to build an independent infrastructure for government networks. And even if you try, there are various gotchas. So there are many things to be looked at there. So how do you go about doing governance of an intelligence network? Well, again, the Snowden documents reveal that this is extraordinarily difficult. The core of the governance of the network at whose heart the NSA sits is the Five Eyes countries, and they have meetings from time to time to decide what the rules will be internally. And Edward Snowden gave us the minutes from some of these meetings so we can see what goes on. For example, 2 years ago, there was a meeting at GCHQ in Cheltenham which decided the extent to which intelligence agencies had to minimize data that they collected about each other's citizens. So if, for example, my phone metadata or location history were to reveal that I'd visited an HIV clinic, would that sort of thing be able to be broadcast throughout the whole system, or would it have to be minimized, have my name or IP address or whatever removed? And only Canada requested that its citizens' data be minimized. So what's happening is that, in effect, GCHQ is happy for the NSA to read my records, the NSA is happy for GCHQ to read your records, and as this is a law school, I can't avoid mentioning that the NSA was also quite happy for the Australian intelligence services to read US attorney-client communications in respect of some disputed mining operation in Indonesia, if memory serves. So if you leave the control of privacy to national intelligence agencies, it ain't going to be protected, because with the honorable exception of Canada, that just wasn't on the agenda. And interestingly enough, the reason that Canada wanted its citizens' medical records minimized is that in Canada, if you fill out a government form with personal information, then officially it's confidential once completed, so it falls within the classification mechanism. That isn't the case in the USA or the UK, where health, privacy, and national security run under completely different laws and rubrics. That gives us perhaps a hint of one of the possible control mechanisms. Law enforcement network governance, on the other hand, is much more straightforward. It's much more open. It's all about mutual legal assistance treaties. And there's all sorts of things that are being done to accelerate the process. But fundamentally, in theory, when police forces share information, everything gets filtered by lawyers. It may, in practice, be paralegals or even techies, but in principle, the lawyers can descend on a particular piece of information sharing and decide whether that should be happening or should not be happening. So far, so good. But here's the next problem. Are we going to have one network or many? Because those of us who do research in networks know that networks tend to merge over time. There have been numerous attempts to create an Internet 2.0, you know, a new, faster, sexier, more robust, more secure Internet. And none of these work because the existing Internet just goes and the new one is absorbed pretty well without trace. So here's a really, really big question. Is the intelligence network, that is what we see emerging with the NSA and GCHQ and intelligence services in Sweden and India and Israel and so on, is that going to merge with the law enforcement network, such as it is? And we already see cases where intelligence resources are used to get rapid solution of exceptional crimes. For example, in the UK, last year there were some bad people hacked the British Pregnancy Advisory Service and got a list of tens of thousands of their clients and threatened to publish these as a protest against abortion. Help, said the police to GCHQ. GCHQ said, why don't you break down that door there? And they did, and they found the bad people. Now, if you can use intelligence resources to stop really bad things happening, then clearly you're tempted to do it again and again and again. And in Britain, all police wiretapping is done by something called NTAC, which is in effect a service window at GCHQ. Why should the taxpayer pay for the same thing twice? Why should there be two groups of people who know how to tap phones? And here in the USA, The parallel thing is PRISM. Everybody was shocked in June last year when we learned about PRISM, when we learned about the NSA hoovering up your Gmail and your Hotmail and so on. And it turned out that that was simply an NSA codename for the FBI getting stuff by means of warrants. So it was actually not that objectionable. It was lawful, targeted, and so on. But this is just an example of how intelligence networks and law enforcement networks come ever more closely together. So what direction is the governance going to take? Well, here we've got an interesting problem, because many of you will have seen the PCAST report, the report of the Presidential Council of Advisors in Science and Technology, where its authors, including Eric Schmidt and Craig Mundy, conceptualize big data as being a whole bunch of firms that collect data, like the firm that sold you your kid's teddy bear with that wonderful speech and gesture recognition interface, and the big data backend that does the signal processing. And then there's the aggregators who take all this data, your shopping data, your mobile phone location, you know, what your kid was waving his hands in front of the teddy bear. They take all that information and they stir it up and they produce something valuable that's then sold to the firms who are actually using it to market stuff. And the PCAST report said that control should only go on users, that there are too many collectors for it to be worthwhile controlling them, and controlling the aggregators would, in some sense, be wicked. And within a week, the European Court of Justice disagreed in the Gonzalez case, and it said that, in effect, Google in Spain must answer to Spanish warrants because, you know, they do business in Spain, they've got staff in Spain, Spain has laws, and that's how it has to be. And an aggregator such as Google can republish obscure facts and also combine non-sensitive facts to make a sensitive one. So this, in the context of European data protection law, is only to be expected. So here we've got a big split between America and Europe, where America has favored freedoms, freedom of speech, and Europe has favored rights, privacy rights. And if this is going to lead to a fork in the road, then the implications for intelligence and law enforcement networks could be interesting. But what sort of controls could you have in a converged intelligence network? Suppose you just have a global intelligence network that emerges as a sort of new multinational institution, you know, like the World Bank, but with better computers. Would this mean that the NSA could use everything? The FBI could use some subset of it? And the California State Police could use a smaller amount, and the local dog catcher could use a still smaller amount? Well, this is difficult, I think, and lawyers should be thinking about this because of the issue of separation of powers. If the executive is omniscient, and those parts of the state apparatus, such as local police forces, that are subject to a reasonable amount of transparency and democratic control, see only a very, very small part of that, then what's going to happen in the long term to power? And what sort of controls, legal or technical, are feasible for the collection stage or for the aggregation stage? Now, we may tackle that somewhat differently in Europe from how it's tackled in America, but I suspect that in the medium term and perhaps even in the short term, most countries are going to have to start thinking about what controls do you have on collection? Is it okay, for example, if we move into a world where every inhabited space has cameras and microphones in it, and where these cameras and microphones are connected to the cloud in order to drive gesture-based and voice-based interfaces, that you can simply presume consent to information sharing, for example, from kids? And I don't know how it is here, but in Britain, kids under 10 legally can't consent to anything. Or does mummy have to pick up the teddy bear and press the I consent to data sharing button before the bear, you know, reads the bedtime story to the kids? You know, precisely how is this going to work out? There's another point here, which is, as Larry Lessig used to say, code is law. And the engineer's response to that is that, well, if code is law, then architecture is policy. If you build things in a centralized way, then you may end up with very different long-term results from if you build them in a decentralized way. and the architecture that one builds can lay a very, very long trail behind it. For example, our railway gauge is still 4'8.5", which is a Roman cart axle. And Britain's main usefulness to the USA in the intelligence space is the fact that 30% of the internet goes through British territory or territory controlled by British allies. Why? Because we ran the world from 1815 to 1914, which is when transatlantic cables and so on were first laid. And so they were laid along British colonial trading routes. And if you happen to have access to places like Cornwall and Gibraltar and Oman and so on, then you can hoover up an awful lot of bits. Architecture persists. So this brings me to the international relations community. What sort of effect is this going to have on the people whose business it is to think about government and to hold meetings in DC where diplomats brainstorm and generals come along and present their latest plans and so on? Well, the international relations community is roughly split into a couple of schools. You've got realists, Thucydides, Machiavelli, Hobbes, Kissinger, who take the world, who take the view that the world is a zero-sum game, it's dog-eat-dog, and everybody is looking out for number one. And then you've got the idealists or the liberals, going back to perhaps Kant, President Wilson, Kahane among current academics, and Bill Clinton among recent political leaders, who take the view that, yes, there is a tendency to a zero-sum game, but international institutions matter, and there are things that you can do to build trust, for example, to stop prisoners' dilemmas escalating into thermonuclear exchanges during the Cold War. And when I started digging into this, I found that essentially nobody seems to have considered network effects in this whole community. Bob Axelrod's about the only exception. One or two people have talked about networks, but they're talking about networks in different senses, in the sense of Barabashi, and the references are rare and passing references only. Now, it strikes me that once we understand the growing relevance of network effects in the likely conduct of states in the future, then this adds a lot of weight to the liberal side of the argument, right? There are things other than simply the pure selfish behavior of nation states on a dog-eat-dog basis. And in fact, if you had a realist interpretation of the surveillance world, then this would have rather depressing implications. So as I mentioned, Britain's value to the USA in terms of the NSA-GCHQ relationship is that thanks to Queen Victoria, God bless her soul, we provide access to 30% of the internet. And if code is law and architecture is policy, then we have to ask, what are we embedding in the infrastructure and how will it affect our descendants? Because, you know, if we build a world with highly centralized structures of power, then what happens in 50 years' time or 100 years' time or 500 years' time once America is no longer top dog? Once it's perhaps the ruler of China or the ruler of India or the United States of Africa. And maybe it will be that the liberties that the NSA takes with farmers in the Punjab or fishermen in Somalia now are taken with Americans in 100 or 300 years' time, once the boot's on the other foot. So solving the governance problem is of immense long-term importance if we are to fulfill the liberals' dream of moving from a world where one empire is succeeded by another, by another, by another, to a world in which there are no more empires, but simply a community of nations, then we have to take into account what's happening in the IT and intelligence and conflict spaces as well. That means coming up with some workable way of dealing with the governance problem. Now, it's unlikely to be a perfect solution, but the international institutions that we've built over the past 60 years or so have certainly been valuable in preventing recurrences of what happened in World War II. There are many other network effects in government, EU laws, financial regulation, big projects like Europe's Smart Meter Program. You can read about them in the paper. I'm not going to spend any time on these. I'm just going to go on to conclusion slide, and then we can hand over to the discussants. The first point is that the big gap between San Francisco and DC isn't just on whether Snowden's a whistleblower or a traitor. Peter Swire remarked that everybody he spoke to on the West Coast reckoned that Snowden was a whistleblower, and everybody who spoke on the right coast reckoned he was a traitor. Hey, that's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is that the economic models are almost totally different. In this part of the world, people understand network effects, and in DC, they've never heard of them. And the point that I have been arguing today is that models of the economics and security of security and privacy that were pioneered at Berkeley a dozen years ago can, I think, obviously do apply here too. This work goes back to earlier work at Berkeley on understanding the economics of networks in general. And the reason it's important to do work on these problems is that they have got huge implications from international relations to, as a law school should be interested in, separation of powers and the rule of law. How do you go about governing a networked world where law enforcement, intelligence, and other such networks flow together and tend to merge, are difficult to separate, and are really problematic to control? What's the way forward?
Thank you so much, Ross. And now we will hear from Carl Shapiro.
Well, that was a really easy question you posed at the end, so I'll just answer that one, the way forward. Hi. This is kind of an unusual assignment for me. I don't usually focus on security or surveillance. I touch on privacy, but I think more about competition and the economic factors. So here I am. When I saw the title, Network Effects Meet Public Choice, I was like, okay, I'm in here for network effects, but I don't know who's going to win that battle. I think maybe network effects is what how I interpret the talk. Despite my not being a surveillance person, we have others here. In fact, on the panel, it's a great variety here. I mean, the four of us. So, it's a just cool thing to be part of. But it warmed my heart, of course, because Ross says network effect. He goes through some of the basic economics, besides that in my book with Hal Varian. Appreciate it. Network effects, low marginal cost for information, lock-in. Okay, now you're talking. Now I'm with you. And I would say, seeing Ross do some economics here, way better than I would do cryptography or computer science. So, you get credit for that. I appreciate that. I work on antitrust, economics of innovation, competitive strategy. And so what I want to do is pick up on those threads of Ross's talk in his paper and translate those. How do we apply those thoughts into government surveillance, the government sector, and there's an international relations component here to be sure. Okay. Now, so I already told you my qualifications are kind of sketchy here. But I have had some time, being, as Paul mentioned, being on the President's Council of Economic Advisors, worked in the White House for a couple of years. So there's a National Economic Council there, which coordinates economic policy. And then there's the National Security Council, which does more of the international relations security. Some people are dual-hatted. They're working for both. And there's overlap, obviously, between those two issues. So sometimes there'd be overlap. And we economists at the Council of Economic Advisors, we get brought in to handle some of the economic issues that would spill over with the security issues. So a good example was a lot of pressure we were putting on Iran, sanctions, dealing with concern about their developing nuclear program. So the economists got brought in to talk about world oil markets and cutting back on Iranian supply of oil and how this would affect world oil prices. So I've been in the Situation Room, done elasticity of demand in the Situation Room, so I figure I'm qualified here. Okay. All right. So I want to pick up on two questions. I guess there's a part in the paper, which it's entertaining, interesting paper. I recommend it to you. In the second page, I just want to pick on this because it gets animated what I think Ross is trying to do and my response to it. He says, the Snowden papers reveal an international surveillance network whose scale surprised even industry insiders and security experts. In order to understand how this might be brought under appropriate political, judicial, and social control, we need to understand its dynamics, so the dynamics of that network. So that's kind of what I'm picking up on, the dynamics or the evolution of this surveillance network, and that is a network, so we bring in some of these economic concepts. And in particular, there's two pieces then. One is this relation between So one is, how do we think the network economics that many economists develop for the private sector, can we really translate that over to the public sector? How does it do when we translate it over? Is there other problems? And then the other thing that comes up quite importantly is the interface between law enforcement and surveillance or intelligence operations. And I think that has implications for that as well. Okay. So Ross is a big kind of tipping guy. He says the rational actor will join the biggest network, and his example of India deciding maybe to, you know, side with the U.S. more in terms of intelligence because we have the bigger network. So I would just issue a little bit of a caution on that, okay? Because even in the private sector, traditional network setting, there's there are forces that push against simply one network taking over, okay? In fact, your example of payment systems, Visa, MasterCard, there are a number of different networks, okay, and they compete. So it hasn't all tipped to one. And, you know, the fax machine is still out there. It's just kind of losing ground to email, but they coexisted for a while, Mac and Windows, and so forth. So it's not as though everything tips. So we really need to be aware of the forces in commercial sector that keep some balance. And that's going to translate over, particularly when strategic issues apply. You know, why did Google develop Chrome, for example? There's a perfectly good browsers out there. Part of it was a broader strategic battle with Microsoft. Okay, maybe they developed Android in part because of the battling with Apple that had a lot of other issues. Well, if you're thinking about international relations, it's not simply are you going to share information with this other country or not, or intelligence, because they have more information. What are the broader strategic contexts? And that can push against consolidation. In fact, full tipping, what would that be? All countries sharing all their information? That's not going to happen. In fact, the UN, you know, not so good in some ways, right? So I don't think that's the prediction that would and it's not a prediction in the private sector, so I would be cautious a little bit that transferring it over. But there is a disadvantage to being a smaller network, that's true. But there's also the fact that people can be in both networks, right? You don't have to necessarily exclusively pick one or the other. And that's true in the private sector through compatibility. And it's going to be true in the public sector or international relations when people can, you know, be part of different alliances, overlapping alliances, things that change over time. So a little caution there. And then leadership changes. In the private sector, we certainly see those, even when there's strong network effects. You know, tell Lotus 123 about it. Tell MySpace about it, okay? So you could ask, does somebody, because they have a big network now, maybe an intelligence network, is that going to persist? That seems probably pretty durable, a bunch of these, but it's something to ask about. Okay. So let's translate it over to international relations. So on that point, for example, the U.S., you know, we have a big network. We're pretty far ahead in a lot of ways. I think that's going to be pretty durable in terms of our information capabilities, from what I understand about it. You know, I think of an analogy as the dollar is the reserve currency around the world, right? So that basically other countries and many private entities, you know, want to hold dollars. This has long been called the exorbitant privilege of the United States because, you know, like something like 75% of the $100 bills are kept outside the U.S. You imagine who might have those. Very handy if we can print paper and people give us resources from them, and they just have the paper sits around. That's a good deal for us as long as they never cash the paper in. So so those sort of advantages can be very persistent, and I think that is true here on the intelligence side as well. Okay, but other things we might think about. I was kind of playing with this a little bit, Ross, which is, well, what are the other elements of network effects that we talk about in the private sector? So we got compatibility, people trying to join networks. So what would that look like exactly? And join multiple networks, like I said. I'm not sure where all this goes, but I thought I'd throw it out. We've got standards wars. Those are pretty different than shooting wars, I'm pretty sure. But, you know, how would that play out? And we got alliances. I mean, some of the other chapters in information rules actually talk about these other tactics that companies use when there's compatibility issues and network effects. So that's one side. The other is you talked about how there are more economies of scale, and network effects are a form of economy of scale, and talking about even the military side being subject to more economies of scale. That definitely favors the larger countries. You know, that favors just straight out our military, I think. I remember we actually did some stuff with DOD in the 90s during the Clinton administration when we were downsizing. And one of the basic principles of DOD they had was, in terms of procurement, we wanted to be able to fight two fronts at once. right? So that's a big scale allows you to do that. It's actually like a statistical scale economy in the private sector where you don't know where the demand's going to come from, and it's good to be large. I think there's some very significant scale economies here that do translate over. I'm totally with you on that. Okay. The other thing that I think translates over, you think about, is if somebody joins a network in the private sector, you know, Apple, say, has more of a closed network traditionally, whether it's computers or the iPhone, than others. That means they can basically set the terms of access, right? Whether they want royalties for apps providers they can control the network access as opposed to an open network. So this is part of, do you always want to join the big network? Well, maybe not if the big network's terms for joining are onerous. Okay. So, I don't know quite how that's going to translate over, but, you know, if you can think about if the U.S. gets greedy and says, well, small country, if you want to join us, you have to give us a lot of information. We'll give you little dribs and drabs when we feel like it. Maybe it doesn't look so good anymore. And, you know, again, we can see that in the private sector. Maybe we'd see something like that in the public sector. Okay. So the other then big area I want to talk of his question is this law enforcement intelligence boundary, okay, which, you know, anybody who reads the papers, I mean, this is a big deal these days, right? You know, I think it's really a fallout in some sense from 9/11 and the war on terror that so many more resources are going into intelligence and all those activities. It's inevitable some of those will spill over and there will be interactions with law enforcement. Besides, of course, the increased desire to do law enforcement to protect against some of these threats. Okay, so but these are two very, very different types of activities. So first, you'd say, well, okay, it's natural. Information is a fixed cost, so you start to share it between law enforcement and intelligence community, let's say. Then I'm like, well, wait a moment. We really need to bring in organizational economics here as well as network effects. Which is to say, it's really hard to share information across different organizations, particularly in the public sector. Okay, so you know we read in the 9/11 report there were all these they couldn't share the information well, and they couldn't coordinate. There was a lot of money that's been spent to develop technologies for first responders from different state and local entities, fire and police to coordinate. A whole lot of spectrum has been devoted to this. It's a really hard problem. Okay, this type of coordination. So. It's not going to happen easily just because information is a fixed cost. There's all these barriers, okay? Anybody who's watched The Wire can see how the local, police in Baltimore are having a hell of a lot of trouble. You know, there's not an smooth sharing of information with the feds, that's for sure, okay? But even other parts of the public sector, I would say the public sector is worse than the private sector, I guess, is kind of the point for sharing this type of information. I think you mentioned smart meters in your paper. So we worked on smart meters a bunch when I was at the CEA. It was a significant initiative early in the Obama administration. Very hard because it's all these different state regulatory agents, state utility commissions have to decide what to do. It's not a federal thing. And you got all the utilities that you have. So it's indirectly you're controlling them. And the Department of Energy wanted this. So very hard. Electronic medical records, not going so well, really. It's hard, okay. And don't get me started about government procurement. So I think there are all these barriers to sharing information, and we've certainly seen it in the law enforcement intelligence communities, that has got to push against sort of the fixed cost structure. There are other ways to take advantage of the economies of scale and scope, actually. So one thing you can do, public sector, hire a contractor. Okay, that's a great way to get economies of scale. They could do all the stuff and then get some economies of scale. This often happens in the private sector too, and the government take advantage of it. So I think the obvious proposal is to hire data brokers to help the feds out with intelligence. That was not a serious proposal for those of you who are taping this and watching at home. Okay. But that is one way to go. And, of course, the contractors do play an important role here, okay, in terms of how this is all going to play out in practice. So the notion that there are zero marginal costs of sharing information, Maybe you've learned that. You know, I talk about that sometimes. It's really not true when you're crossing organizational boundaries. Share information with another organization, you have to worry, are they going to leak it? Are they going to lose it? What's their security? It's not zero marginal cost anymore, particularly if you've got rivalries between different organizations. So that's a particular obstacle. Okay. So closing, Ross says near the end, I like this, he says, quote, the engineer in me says that architecture will matter, and the economist says that incentives will matter. I like that. I would just say the economist also says that organizations will matter. And it's part of incentives. Organizations matter a lot, particularly in the public sector, which is not so good at sharing, organizing, you know, best practices, et cetera, et cetera. So I would propose an alternative title, not seriously, instead of whatever it was, instead of network effects meet public choice, network effects meet public sector disorganization and dysfunction. Okay, now that's a fair fight. Thanks.
Thank you. And we will hear from James Aquilino.
So full disclosure, I'm the only non-academic here, and my comments today are largely going to be informed by the following things. One is I was in federal law enforcement for 9 years, and I was a federal prosecutor and handled legal process for the terrorist investigation 9/11. I also did a pretty significant terrorist investigation when I was at the U.S. Attorney's Office. Second is I now run a computer forensic and cybersecurity firm that handles a tremendous amount of data breach and incident response work. So, and I would actually probably add as well that I have seen kind of the good and bad related to data in a number of different contexts. And the way that I like to think about the network effect that Ross has described is I'm going to try to address my comments across intelligence, law enforcement, and kind of the civil side of things, as Ross described the lockdown effect, which I think is something important for people who care about privacy to kind of understand. And it's funny because the way I think about user and user privacy is ultimately it's choice. And we can all choose not to be so impatient when the plane lands to turn the phone on to make sure their phone is connecting to a Wi-Fi tower, or to open Google Maps and be impatient that when you press that little arrow down in the left-hand corner, it's not going to immediately figure out where you are, or to download a Scrabble app and not bother to read the terms of service that blatantly identifies for you that all kinds of PII about you residing on your computer is now being reported to a third party. That's how I think about privacy, is that, and it's a very cynical view, but I just want to kind of, I have 10 minutes, so I'm just going to throw out some things to think about as you think about privacy and surveillance. On the one hand, privacy is a choice, and there is an utter impatience and demand for the latest and greatest technology, with complete ignorance or a blind eye to what the price is with respect to your own personally identifiable information. On the intelligence side of things, one of the things that I find personally, and I'm not speaking as a representative of DOJ or even my firm, but personally, one of the things that's frustrating about the conversation is that it often, people don't discuss the impact of the risks associated with there being kind of more restrictive intelligence collection, and that part of the conversation I think is really important. You know, one of the travesties of the Snowden affair, and I look at the way that the public sector dealt with law enforcement before 9/11 and after 9/11, is that it took a really long time, for example, for the ISPs and the government to actually work well together. In the world of law enforcement, and when you're looking at federal criminal law, we're stuck with ECPA and we're stuck with the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which is legislation that was written in the 90s that has not kept up with technology. Okay, pre-9/11, really, really difficult to get data out of ISPs, right? It was 18 U.S.C. 2703A, C, D. 9/11 happens and everything changes. And there's a different dialogue now when something like that happens. And I'll tell you, when I was working 9/11 ops, companies were coming out of the woodwork saying, give me a 2703D order. We have information that may be relevant to the investigation. It changed the way that the conversation took place, essentially, between the government and the and ISPs. And since Snowden, it's had a tremendously negative impact. The ISPs are now, you know, have been painted in a different light. There's a lot more attention to what ISPs are doing and the process that they receive. Formal and informal requests for information are now treated very differently. And yet, everybody, and I think this is fair to say, the public expects the government to nonetheless protect its citizens, and we all know that the threats are real out there, and there's all kinds of threats out there today. And those threats are more and more being availing of technology. So one of the things that I think has been interesting about the Snowden affair and the repercussions of it and the discussions around it is that while people are outraged by the amount of data that has flowed through intelligence sharing programs, there's been less kind of focus, it seems, on the challenge of, on the one hand, kind of meeting and greeting the public's expectation with respect to real threat, and on the other, protecting people's privacy. I mean, all due respect, the Five Eyes don't care about whether you've been to an HIV clinic. What they care about is whether your metadata evidences interaction with those associated with terrorist activity. That's what they care about. And I appreciate how challenging it is to be able to make that kind of distinction. I'm going to skip law enforcement for a second and jump to the civil side of things. Ross made a really good point about lockdown. You know, there's so many emerging companies, particularly in the Bay Area, that are moving so quickly that they're not thinking about the security of what they're building, and they're not thinking about its impact on their customers and their customers' customers. So what happens often is that the cost associated with a breach of the kinds that my firm investigates, you know, advanced persistent threat breach, competitive breach, all kinds of kind of insider threat breach, the cost of actually investigating and responding to an incident where data is stolen is incredible. And that's one of the real travesties of what Ross described as the lockdown effect, which is sometimes we're moving so quickly that not only are we not paying attention to people's rights to their data, but we're not paying attention to the security as kind of a way that we're thinking about building what we're doing. And I guess I'm seeing my time's running out here, and let me just say this about the law enforcement intelligence overlap. So one of the things that's really challenging, and Ross and I were commenting about this right before we started, is that, you know, when I first started in the U.S. Attorney's Office, a typical narcotics case didn't involve computer media. Today, a typical arrest of a mule and a drug transaction includes the collection and seizure of a cell phone or an iPad or some other computer located at a residence where maybe there's a search warrant being effected. And it's completely changing the way normal routine investigations are being conducted. And I'm giving you an example of a reactive crime. The reason I bring this up is that when you look at the law that prescribes certain activity and how it's kept up with technology, it hasn't. And so one of the big challenges for law enforcement is being able to have the resources, the training, and the ability to deal with evidence that is digital. And I raise that because as you think about the effect of Snowden and the impact of that kind of revelation, I'm also thinking about Senator Leahy's bill as an avenue of reform in this regard. What's really unfortunate is that there isn't similarly the same kind of focus on the kind of laws that prescribe criminal activity and and an effort to bring them current with the type of technology that exists today and the way in which technology is now used as an instrumentality of a crime. So with that, I will pass it off to Anupam.
Anupam, and while Anupam's walking up to the deck, I thank folks from BCLT before, and I also should mention I see Chris Hufnagel in the last row, who's the Director of Privacy Programs here at BCLT. So hello, Chris. Thanks.
Let me begin by taking issue with James. So, but let me actually first begin by asking how many of you are lawyers or soon to be lawyers? So the worry, of course, that James is worried that pre-9/11 there wasn't enough cooperation between the ISPs and the FBI and other intelligence services. Post-9/11 there was such cooperation, and now post-Snowden there isn't cooperation again, that kind of dynamic. I'm not so sure I want the cooperation to be without tension. I do not want the ISP to be the surveillance arm of the state, right? And that's the concern, I think. That's why we have, you know, James is a lawyer, educated here, and so he recognizes that, but he's also coming at it from the perspective of being a prosecutor and now a security professional. And so the focus is on security, and much of us, and many of us, are also concerned about not only security, which, you know, I am very concerned about security, but also the abuse of information. And so we know that, you know, we could create a world where this government knows everything about you, right? And so maybe that helps security, but I think the likely scenario is that actually undermines security. And so your security is now jeopardized not necessarily by fellow criminals, but by the state, which we have seen historically has routinely violated people's rights using the information that, that it's had in its storehouse. So I think we want frictions between ISPs and the government and a distance between the two. And so we don't want them, jumping hand over fist to turn over everything, any bit of information. I don't think that's what James means, but I want to put some pressure on James, and he can respond shortly. Okay, so let me give you my brief talk in the next 7.5 minutes. So I'm going to talk about what I call global due process, and other people have discussed these kinds of issues as well. The problem that Ross identifies is the problem of a global information network that becomes a global spying network because of these network effects. So the outline of my comment is going to be discussing the problem, what governments across the world are currently doing about it, and the problems that creates, and offer a potentially better solution. So President Obama, after the Snowden revelations, said this: with respect to the internet, this doesn't apply to U.S. citizens, doesn't apply to people living in the U.S. Okay. President Obama, like many of you, is a lawyer or was once a law student. And this is a perfect statement of the constitutional law on the subject. Okay. So what he is actually doing, this seems like a throwaway line, but in fact he's telling you what the Fourth Amendment rules are in this space. Okay. And imagine yourself now sitting, say, in Germany or sitting, say, in Brazil. How does this make you feel? Not comforted at all. And so that's the focus of my remarks this morning. This is this afternoon, the problem that I identify. So the problem really is that they're in the United States, and I would suggest that this is probably true throughout the world, though I haven't assessed each jurisdiction in turn. There are no effective legal constraints on U.S. surveillance of non-U.S. persons abroad, right? So take the inverse of what President Obama said, and you've got no holds barred, no rights world. Okay, and of course, this fact as well. Most people live outside the United States, and are, you know, a tiny percentage of these might be U.S. persons outside the United States under the definitions in the statute. So here, let me look very quickly. This is going to be the briefest of sketches, the U.S. con law on the subject, and the, you know, the lawyers in the room will recognize this case, Verdugo Urquidez, where the Supreme Court says Verdugo Urquidez, a Mexican who was subject to a search in Mexico, was not one of the, quote, people that the Fourth Amendment protects. Okay, he isn't a person under the Fourth Amendment for Fourth Amendment purposes. And so no rights violated, no constitutional rights violated in the search and seizure in Mexico of a Mexican person without any significant U.S. ties. That's the U.S. person idea, by the way. And you see the presidential order, executive order in 1981, which says, characterized nicely, outside the U.S., the CIA prowls the alleys without a leash, right? That's the worry. Federal statutes are largely consistent with this. They have routinely, so any limitations that the federal statutes provide are limitations designed to protect U.S. persons. Okay, so targeting and minimization requirements in these statutes are entirely to protect people in the U.S., you guys. The LLMs in the room, you're well protected while you're here. Okay. And of course, the U.S. courts in the most recent case, a fascinating case, the Microsoft subpoena. A subpoena given to Microsoft in the U.S. because it owns servers in Ireland. And so the question is whether or not Microsoft is compelled to take from Ireland information about held there. So far, the trial court has ruled that, yes, in fact, the subpoena can go on outside international agreements for information exchange that currently do exist between the U.S. and Ireland. Okay. So that's the problem, the blowback. So this is the current solution. And the solution is a little different than what Ross described just right now. In my view, the governments of the world are actually trying to shut off the internet from each other. They're trying to plug out, unplug from the American internet. And let me give you some examples of this. Okay, so let's look at Brazil. Brazil proposed this spring in Article 12 of the Marco Civil, a kind of radical document, by the way, that said internet users have rights, and so how should we approach the internet regulation from the perspective of users? That's a radical idea, by the way. That's not the way internet regulation has been approached in the United States. Think the DMCA, et cetera. How do we protect copyright holders, or how do we protect trademark holders? That's the way we generally approach internet regulation. But Article 12 would have given President Rousseff, and apparently she may still continue, the right to declare any information to be only held within the country. That is, you can't take this information outside the country. Ultimately, that article in the Marco Civil wasn't passed. The Marco Civil passed without that particular article. And this is part of what I call a second-generation movement in internet border controls. So you're quite familiar with censorship regimes that exist around the world, the Great Firewall of China, stopping information from coming in. Right, the South Sea China Morning Post is banned from coming into mainland China just this last couple weeks. Right, so that's the traditional way of understanding border controls, internet border controls. The new generation, the second generation, is preventing information from getting out, and this is equally dangerous, I'll suggest. Okay. We see in Germany efforts to create a kind of European, and by this the continental European, a Schengen zone for communications, proposed by Deutsche Telekom. And we're not entirely guiltless here, by the way, I should point out. The United States, using its power to regulate foreign investment into infrastructure, into communications infrastructure in the United States, has sometimes used this power to force data localization in the United States as well. So, I'm not just pointing fingers elsewhere. Russia has just passed this as a matter of law. Information about Russians should stay in Russia, we're told. Okay. This creates a huge number of problems, and I won't go through them. You can find, by the way, there's a citation to a paper which is available online that you can see a dozen more jurisdictions which I've surveyed and the problems that they create. Okay, quickly to conclude here. So what are reforms? Reforms, you know, we're quite familiar. James mentioned the USA Freedom Act, which has a kind of, you know, I hate this Orwellian language of freedom, uniting, you know, so this kind of shocking use, obviously used by the USA Patriot Act first in this way. But it does make some important improvements to the current law. At the same time, all the improvements are designed to protect us, you and me and the LLMs in the room while they're in this room, okay? But once they go home, sorry, no rights, no worries. Your information is ours, and we can do whatever we want with it. And so we've seen also, as of January, President Obama declaring all persons should be treated with dignity. That you would think would be unnecessary to say, but it turns out that it's necessary to say. What we need, and to conclude, is a kind of global due process regime where countries agree to treat each other and the information they have about each other, which they will have in this globalized information economy, which the Irish will have information about Americans, the Brazilians will have information about Americans, and we will have information about them. And we need to figure out a way where all countries treat each other's information with some level of due process. Barring that, what we're seeing instead, of course, till that moment, kind of self-help approach. Encrypt everything so that the government has a hard time getting access to it. Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Anupam. And that was really perfect because that's exactly where Ross's paper winds up, as you know, really calling for a kind of global cooperation. But let me do this. Why don't we proceed by you ask James a question, and we'll give him a chance to answer if he wants. And then we'll give Ross, if he wishes, a chance to respond to the comments on his paper, and then we'll open it up to the audience. So, James,
No, actually, why don't we let Ross respond, and then we can maybe take questions
perfect.
And further respond.
I don't have anything particular to respond. I mean, some of the comments that Carl made are perfectly fair. And as we start developing the economics of surveillance as a discipline, clearly there will be lots of questions to be investigated with both theory and empirical tools.
Okay, and then I guess the only thing I would add before we have questions and we have microphones to the right and to the left, so step up if you'd like, if you have a question to ask of Ross or our other panelists, is that just in using the economics framework that Ross points out, I think the big difference post-Snowden is that there were externalities, as it were, for the ISPs and other American companies in terms of spying on people outside of the country and inside the country that essentially they didn't have to bear because no one knew about it. And so for whether it's Google or Microsoft or whoever it was, the kind of quote-unquote cost of cooperating with the government was very low because there was no publicity about it. And so then to the extent that there was a preference, let's say, for people in this country or outside the country not to have their product by Microsoft or Google or Facebook have that information shared with the government, that preference was irrelevant because they didn't know what was going on. So now that cost is actually borne by the companies, and what we're seeing is that companies like, for example, Microsoft with Brad Smith taking a very public role, calling for ECBA reform, calling for FISA reform. So that's one way in which the economics have changed. The only other thing I would add, since you mentioned public choice theory in the paper, is that, and as we discussed this afternoon, is that there is such gridlock right now in Washington that where 15 years ago, it would have been so clear there would have been some kind of ECBA reform by now, I was at a meeting 2 weeks ago in D.C. where we had Chris Calabresi from the ACLU there and David Lieber from Google talking about how they really have a dog and pony show where they go from office to office on Capitol Hill saying, this is what the ACLU and Google want together. This is what we're willing to sign off on. Can you please enact this law? And they're just getting nowhere with it so far. And it was so funny seeing the two of them. I don't know if this could be like a future sitcom or something, because you could tell it was so, like, they have been to so many offices and they've really kind of begged for the reform and it's going nowhere. And or thus far, let's say the future is uncertain of even something where it seems everybody agrees to. So I wonder, Ross, how that then kind of affects the economics of the situation if there is no response from Washington.
Well, every country has got its own political issues and costs. We've got a coalition government in Britain. We've got very complex maneuverings around what's called the DRIP bill. And the DRIP bill is basically designed to reduce the costs for non-US law enforcement in getting at information that's kept by large US service firms. Previously, if the Cambridgeshire Constabulary wanted stuff in Google servers, they could file paperwork through a mutual legal assistance treaty and wait for 6 weeks. The DRIP bill decrees that the government has got the power to serve a secret warrant on Google, after which it will be possible for the local law enforcement agencies to simply subpoena stuff for relevant investigations. And I will be interested to see what the world is like once every government passes laws like that, declaring that it has the right to help itself to any information in the servers of any company which has employees on their territory. I spoke to a senior person at a big Silicon Valley firm, and he gave the following real-life example. What happens when a family court in India files a warrant for access to the email of a citizen of Canada who's never been to India and attaches a permanent secrecy order? How can you assure your citizens, your customers in Canada that they've got any privacy if you're ever going to have an employee in India? How can you continue to do business in a world where every government seeks to reduce its cost of investigations to what they were in America until a bit over a year ago? This is the sort of real-life problem within which lawyers, both practicing lawyers and constitutional lawyers and people in legislatures, are going to have to wrestle with. And if Congress can't do it, then presumably it's going to be the executive or the Supreme Court, which will have to make the decisions.
Thank you. Do we have any questions?
If you guys have any questions, raise your hand and we'll bring the mic to you. You don't have to run up here.
There was an article on Politico a while ago that said that both the federal government and the corporations are spying. So in a way, they're both living in glass houses. That's why they're not really going after one another. So you would expect the government to rein in on corporate spying, right? But because they're spying themselves, they're not going after corporations as much. I don't know what you make of this theory.
Well, the fundamental problem is not that corporations indulge in industrial espionage on each other, but that a small subset of America's corporations has got vast amounts of personal information that are relevant to both law enforcement and intelligence tasks. That, I think, is a slightly different problem. Now, of course, if you are a big service firm in the Valley, you may forbid your staff from using your competitors' email services, but I think that's a minor consideration by comparison.
Question in the front.
Yeah, just a simple question. Is Snowden a great patriot or a traitor?
Well, as someone who has spent much more time in the Valley than in D.C., my gut reaction is to see him as a whistleblower rather than as a traitor. of course, people in London, in the, those parts of London that are inhabited by the military and intelligence community, they take much the same view as in D.C.
I think I would not paint the brush so broadly in terms of the coasts, having spent several years in D.C. and more time out here. I think there maybe there's kind of a law enforcement perspective, wherever the people are, and maybe more of a technology industry perspective might be a more useful way to slice it than geographical. Obviously, there's correlation.
A number of years ago, we had treaties to ban landmines. We had attempts to ban chemical weapons, and there was a development of public international law and the implementation of treaties that led to these bans. They're not always observed, but at least the international community spoke in many contexts. I'm wondering if any of you might comment about the potential development of international treaties through the United Nations, through other bodies, regarding treatment of networks, treatment of data, privacy, hacking, those things that we see that are transnational problems.
Well, there is in Europe a long tradition of policy laundering, in that if powerful governments want to get something through that they might find difficult to sell to their national parliaments, they get the European Commission and the European Parliament to pass a regulation as quietly as they can, and then come gleefully to Parliament saying, look, our hands are tied. We've got a treaty. We have to ratify it. Otherwise, our name will be mud. So on the one hand, there are mechanisms for using treaties as an end run around legislative gridlock. On the other hand, the issues around you know, network effects, the surveillance community and international relations are so big and so thorny and so poorly understood in national capitals that I can't see us going down that road anytime soon. I would think it's perhaps more likely that one country after another will have to wrestle with a whole series of cases like the India-Canada case that I mentioned, some of which will become hot-button issues locally, until eventually people move with hopefully NGOs and industry pushing in broadly the same direction towards some kind of way forward that may indeed involve treaties. And if a treaty is needed in order to get benefits that lots of people in D.C. want, lots of people in law enforcement want, for example, suppose that efficient access by the Cambridgeshire Constabulary to my Gmail, even if I'm sitting in San Francisco, is considered to be a high-grade public good. And similarly, efficient access by the UC Berkeley police to your Gmail, even if you're sitting in Taiwan, is also a public good. And the cost of delivering that is that you have to have mutual respect of due process, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Then maybe that's the sort of thing in which you can have a treaty.
Carl, James?
Totally different perspective I'll give you. Three things. One, ever since Obama's executive order on cybersecurity, there has been a sharing of information between the public and private sector in this country of a totally different ilk. It's far more robust. In part, I think, as you probably see in the press every day, there's some mention of a new data breach. Law enforcement has actually relaxed the type of information that it will share with the private sector, particularly with respect to distribution of malicious code, advanced persistent threat, any kind of activity that is believed by many to be at the behest of a state-sponsored actor. And so when I was at the U.S. Attorney's Office and, you know, one of the agencies came to me and identified a company that was a victim in some way, you know, I had an indicator of compromise that this company was owned. It was very hard for me to communicate exactly what I knew to that victim corporation. Today, it's a very different thing. At the international level, there's a lot more informal cooperation with respect to cyber and cyber attacks. I've been involved in a number of matters recently where I've been able to obtain information through informal channels, and I've provided information on behalf of victim companies in the U.S. And I guess the third comment that I wanted to make, both in response to your question and the earlier question, is that I cannot tell you the number of companies that exist, because they're moving fast and furiously and focused on the business, that are completely unaware of the information that they are actually amassing. They don't know how they're storing it. They don't know whether they're transmitting it. They don't know where it is. They don't know what it is. And it's typically only when there's been an incident that has implicated the PII of somebody that suddenly they're paying attention. So just for perspective, it's amazing how many companies today don't even know what they're collecting.
Well, I mean, without wading into specifics, because other folks here know them a lot more than I do know that the founders, our founders in their wisdom, to have a treaty, you have to have a supermajority in the Senate. And maybe they teach you law students that. Okay. It strikes me as to get the political enough consensus to have a treaty that strengthens our law enforcement is harder now after Snowden, whilst to get enough consensus to protect civil liberties more, whatever PII, whatever, is impossible, very, very hard as well for given what you need in the Senate. So I don't see that treaties are much of a solution, and that is a lot broader than this area. I mean, there's very few things you can get a supermajority in the Senate for. So it sounds nice, but doesn't feel very practical in the short term.
So just as a slight amendment on the law, that is what the Constitution says, but it's not the general practice. So congressional executive agreements are the way that most international agreements are now entered into because of the fact that you can't get two-thirds of the Senate to agree to anything. And so NAFTA is a congressional executive agreement.
So thank you for the – but there must be some limit to that. Otherwise, you'd be kind of going around the Constitution, huh?
Well, there's a paper about how treaties are dead by Professor Hathaway at Yale Law School. This is the current reigning constitutional law on the subject. But anyway, that's put that aside. But as a slight other amendment on the law, given I'm speaking to lots and lots of soon-to-be lawyers, the United States is not a signatory to the International Landmines Treaty, and that's a shame of the United States. So let's not assume that we've succeeded in other domains on the international front. This is one of the many domains that remains for international cooperation. We cite the Bagram Air Force Base and the DMZ as the prime reasons why we need anti-personnel landmines. It's I think, sad. We are users of these things in these places, so we're not yet willing to give them up. The Obama administration has made some tentative moves that are promising, though hard to see exactly what's going to happen. Is there a promise here of improvement? The fact is we are going to soon be in a world where everyone has information on everyone else. This is Ross's world that he's imagining. There is reason for the United States to say, hey, look, the Irish have information about Americans. Do we want them to not have any controls over that information? So there is this reciprocal nature of this information. The servers are everywhere, whether you use Google or not. You don't know whether the servers are in the United States. There is reason for this, whether that actually causes governments to enter into international agreement through an executive, congressional executive agreement in the United States, most likely, or even a sole executive agreement, which is an even more radical concept, is hard to know.
Thank you. Do we have any? We have another question.
Yeah, two quick questions. The first was on the laws protecting U.S. citizens against collection of information. Is there any verbiage in there that protects us from collection of data from other sources, like other countries, which could then just share that information with U.S. people, and then, you know, they'd kind of be just going around the law, and therefore we'd have actually no real protection. And then the second question was, when it came to types of data that might be collected by the government, et cetera, specifically HIV was mentioned, and it seems like if you have a terminal illness, that would dramatically increase the likelihood that you'd be a suicide bomber, for instance, or something like that. Is that not a valuable piece of information? Would information like that not be something that's valuable to the intelligence community? Thanks.
So I think that's an Anupam question and then a James question, maybe.
So this is an accusation that there is clear that people have accused the United States of using foreign intelligence services to spy on Americans to do an end run around American targeting and minimization requirements. I don't know whether that's the case, but that is clearly out there. You asked the question about, is that permissible? I think a lot of people would say no, but I think this is a question that others might say yes.
James, and what about the thought that maybe that health status information is of interest to intelligence agencies?
I don't see it in my experience. I mean, it's just, you know, if you've ever thought about the amount of data that is potentially available for analytics of any kind, and the type of analytics that you need to perform on terabytes and terabytes of data to actually get to the bottom of or whatever it is that you care about, it's not an easy thing. And I'll give you a completely different example, but to make the point. I had a situation recently where I was given 500 terabytes of uncompressed data, and I had 11 hours to find 3 records in 700 million lines of logs, okay? And we used an AWS technology called Elastic MapReduce, and we wrote some scripts, and we figured it out. But I'll tell you that often, from an intelligence standpoint, one of the travesties about the Snowden affair is that there was a lot of collaboration from an R&D perspective happening between these 5 countries. And that's expensive, it's sophisticated, and an environment where you can share that level of understanding is really, really powerful. And in some ways, that has been dismantled. Not dismantled, but certainly negatively impacted. So I think that when people think about big data and analytics of big data, I think sometimes it's important to remember that today we're talking about big data that's way bigger than it was 10 years ago. And second is the ability to analyze very, very large data sets for something that is anomalous or something that is of interest is a very precise process. And so it is not the case, in my experience, that you can interpret very large data sets to extract, you know, 500 things of interest in a really powerful way. It's far more powerful to extract a few things of interest, for what it's worth.
Excellent. We have another question.
So with regard to barriers like that, you know, we have so much data, and looking for particular characteristics amidst that data is technologically infeasible at this point. My question, I guess, would go potentially to Ross. Do you think that that's true? Do you think that technology is a barrier forever, right? We've seen incredible leaps in the amount of data we can collect and the amount of data we can process. Is it true that this obscurity of data will ultimately protect us? And then the other question I have also concerns barriers. Is self-help, this concept that we can encrypt the data that's passing, actually going to pass muster legally in any for any significant amount of time, because ultimately somebody's got those keys, and how long before basically we just legislate our way into bypassing that encryption myth?
Well, second question first. The crypto wars during the 90s foreshadowed many of the issues that we're now talking about today. We thought that the key escrow had died. It had merely been resting. As far as scale and complexity, well, the main eye-opener for me in the Snowden revelations is that until then, I had assumed, you know, as Carl said in his talk, that government's inability to do large IT projects was largely protecting us. And having met many people from GCHQ, et cetera, who are of at best marginal competence, I came to the conclusion that perhaps the tinfoil hat brigade were overdoing things. When Snowden came out, it became clear that there were, as I put it at the time, some surprising pockets of competence within NSA and GCHQ. They had thrown enough billions at enough contractors for long enough that eventually they found some people who could write code and make it work. And when you look at the details of what they have built with things like X Keyscore, I mean, that's just how companies like Google or Microsoft would have done it. You keep the data in the data centers where it's collected. You do distributed searches. You have indexes for metadata. You have separate repositories for SMSs, phone calls, yada, yada, yada. This is just everyday engineering. So I don't think you can hide behind hopes of obscurity and scale. Given the way the world is going nowadays, the NSA can do to, you know, our communications data just what Google can do to websites. So this is not something that can be solved by technology. It's got to be something, at least part of whose solution comes from lawyers. Now, of course, to write laws that will be effective, you have to speak to the technologists so that we can advise you on what's likely to work and what's not likely to work. And if there isn't that communication, then we will see the sort of mix-ups we had during the crypto wars, where in the evocative words of one senior lawyer, that to begin with, the arguments of lawyers and engineers went through each other like angry ghosts. That's what we have to avoid. You know, we've got to get everybody involved in this policy process, talking together and working together.
Thank you. Anyone else? Well, we've got one more question.
Given the Ebola epidemic, how do you guys fall on that issue in terms of medical privacy?
Can I just say something about this? So there you've got the mission creep problem, right? Why not use this information? Okay, so we collected this data for terrorism purposes. Well, this is an important purpose, protecting individuals from medical disease and devastating illnesses, right? But then you've got the family court example. You know, well, this person's a child abuser. We need to find information about him or her. Okay, well, this person's hasn't paid alimony. We need the information so that we can get this child taken care of. Every public policy has a public policy, and there is a rationale for it. The mission creep is inevitable in these contexts. When the information is there, there will be more and more demands to expand the permissible bases for querying that data set. And governments will be very reluctant to say, no, this is not a proper request. And the worry is not necessarily that there's a lot of legitimate reasons to access that information, but there are a lot of illegitimate reasons to access that information. And that is, I think, the most significant problem.
I think there's another take on this, which is that one of the great problems that we see, at least in Britain, with the national security establishment is that there's an awful lot of rent-seeking going on. An awful lot of activities are beginning to be brought within the national security remit so that jobs can be provided for recently retired persons from GCHQ, from the agencies, and indeed more senior people like agency heads and ministers. And we have seen this being a problem in finance. We've seen it being a problem in transport. And to go back to your question now about healthcare, I would say that the last thing you want to do when you've got a public health hazard like Ebola is to let the national security establishment have anything whatsoever to do with it. We had a problem for a number of years in Cambridge in that we were not allowed to admit students from the Sudan to study for medical degrees. And this was because the national security establishment, through MI5, which ran a visa vetting scheme, believed that there would be a risk that people from Sudan, which at that time had a hardcore Islamist government, would use medical skills to create biological weapons. After all, South Africa, the former apartheid South Africa, had its biological weapons program run by its prime minister's personal physician, and the biological weapons program in Iraq was supposedly run by somebody who got a PhD in Britain, and this was used to block Sudanese students from becoming doctors at British universities. The then pro-vice-chancellor of the university, who was by no means a lefty softy, said this was completely mad, because if in Khartoum there weren't any people who understood public health issues, then the next time something like Ebola came down the Nile, it could end up costing us millions and millions of dead. So it's a matter of horses for courses, and by all means let the national security people run after the terrorists, but for goodness sake, don't let them get in the way of public health.
Let's see if we have any. Thank you. James, Carl, any closing words on anything?
Well, let's.
Okay. Let's call up Robert, the great Robert Barr, executive director of the BCLT, who's going to present an award to Ross while he's coming up here. I'd like to thank the speakers and the attendees. Also, let me tell you quickly about some coming events. October 28th, we'll have a USPTO multi-stakeholder forum. November 7th, U.S.-China IP Summit in Los Angeles. And December 11th, Private Security and Regulatory Space in Search of the Public Interest here in Berkeley.
For the 10th annual BCLT Privacy Lecture, this is something to remember us by. We will remember you for a great presentation and a great discussion. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you.